Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 95.
Imagine for a second losing the one physical object that supposedly anchors your entire soul to reality.
Yeah, that's a terrifying thought.
Right, and I'm not talking about losing a sentimental keepsake or, you know, a family heirloom. I mean a literal, tangible object that serves as the metaphysical tether keeping your consciousness locked inside your body.
Like the actual hardware of your soul.
Exactly. If it goes missing, you don't just feel sad. Your core identity begins to, well, evaporate. And then imagine that at the exact same moment you realize this metaphysical anchor is gone, your family loses the one person who is anchoring them to political survival in the unforgiving machinery of the real world.
I mean, it is a scenario of absolute unmitigated collapse. You're watching the internal spiritual foundation of a bloodline completely shatter right at the exact same second their external political armor just disintegrates.
That's wild.
The sheer velocity of the destruction is breathtaking.
And that is the exact nightmare we are dissecting today, Chapter 95 of Dream of the Red Chamber. We are looking at an absolute masterclass in compounding crises.
We really are.
We're going to examine how this massive, historically insulated family reacts when the mystical, the medical, and the political all cave in on them, like simultaneously.
Yeah, it all happens at once.
And to set the stage for you, the listener, we are dropping right into the middle of a catastrophic domestic emergency. Jia Baoyu has lost his jade.
The worst possible thing.
Literally. Yeah. The mystical amulet he was born with is just gone. And what starts as a frantic, localized search for a missing stone through the gardens is about to trigger a devastating sequence of events that fundamentally alters the reality of everyone in the household.
Because in the ecosystem of this novel, you have to understand that jade is not metaphor.
Right.
It is not merely a symbol of wealth or like a marker of Bayou's elite status. To the people living in this compound, it is a functional, irreplaceable piece of metaphysical hardware.
It's his core component.
Exactly. It's the core component of his existence. When it vanishes, every single hidden fracture within the household just start to crack wide open. The vast class divides, the suffocating prophecies, the immense unspoken pressures of their social hierarchy. It all buckles under the strain.
And, you know, the initial reaction to the missing jade is this perfect psychological study in how people process a sudden crisis. Like, we start at the absolute ground level with the servant class.
Oh, beaming.
Yes, beaming. One of the pages. He comes sprinting in with what he genuinely believes is a brilliant practical solution.
He's so proud of it, too.
He really is. He's been spending time out on the streets near the pawn shops, right?
Yeah.
And he overhears that people are pawning pieces of jade for, like, 300 to 500 cash.
So his grand idea to save the day
is simply to grab a string of coins, run down to the local pawnbroker, and buy a replacement.
It is a wonderfully absurd moment. But, you know, it reveals a profound disconnect in how value is understood across different strata of society. Yiming is operating strictly on street-level transactional logic. He exists in an economy of copper cash where everything is a commodity. To him, a piece of jade is just a rock that can be exchanged for a few hundred coins.
Right. You lose one rock, you go to the market, you buy another rock.
Exactly. He tells Baoyu about the going rate, 300 cash one day, 500 the next, with just total earnestness. He completely believes he has solved an existential crisis with a bit of loose change.
It perfectly captures that frantic mindset, you know, where you try to apply a mundane solution to a supernatural problem.
Oh, for sure.
It's like watching the keystone of an ancient stone archway crumble, threatening to bring the entire thousand-year-old structure down, and someone runs up with a roll of duct tape saying, "Hey, don't worry, I bought this at the hardware store. We'll just tape it back together."
That's a great analogy. It completely misses the intrinsic ontological value of what was actually lost.
And that street-level ignorance is immediately contrasted with the grounded, panicked reality of the senior household staff. Because Siren, the senior maid, she shuts Beaming's idea down without a second thought.
She understands the world far better than he does.
She really does. She points out the obvious reality. Poor people, those who live hand to mouth, they often possess cheap, insignificant little jade trinkets.
Yeah, and when winter comes or the harvest fails and they run out of money to buy food, they pawn those trinkets.
Right. She realizes instantly that a dingy street corner pawn shop is the absolute last place in the empire. You are going to find a divine, luminous amulet that a boy miraculously carried in his mouth from the womb.
What is so telling about that scene, though, is that the text notes that for a brief, fleeting moment, everyone in the courtyard was actually listening to Beaming.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the panic is so thick in the air that even the smart people in the room entertain this foolish idea for a second. It takes Zirin to snap them out of it.
That just shows the sheer, blinding desperation of the moment. They're grasping at anything.
Anything at all.
But when those worldly solutions, like overturning every rockery in the garden and considering the pawn shops, when those inevitably fail, that is when the human mind instinctively pivots. If the physical world cannot provide the answer, you have to look to the spiritual world.
Which leads us directly to the attempted spiritual intervention.
Yeah.
And this is one of the most sociologically revealing scenes in the text.
The visit to the hermitage.
Yes, Xuyin goes to visit Miaoyu at the Green Jade Hermitage to ask for help. Now, Miaoyu is a deeply complex figure. She's a nun, yes, but she is an aristocratic nun.
Right, she's not just a humble ascetic.
Not at all. She has built her entire identity around a ferocious, almost hostile purity. So when Xuyin arrives and asks her to perform fuji, which is a form of spirit writing or divination, Miaoyu's immediate reaction is to scoff.
She totally rejects it.
She essentially claims total ignorance, stating she doesn't associate with secular, power-hungry affairs and doesn't even know what spirit writing entails.
Which is such an obvious defense mechanism. I mean, she lives in a hermitage within the grounds of a wildly wealthy, politically connected family.
She's right in the middle of it.
Exactly. She's constantly surrounded by their drama, their wealth, their inevitable decline. So she protects herself by projecting this aura of total detachment.
She even tells Xuyin she only tolerates her company because Xuyin isn't a social climber.
Right. Being asked to pull out a divination tray to track down a lost piece of jewelry offends the carefully curated persona she has spent years perfecting.
But the brilliance of the text is in her sudden reversal, because Xuyin does not let her off the hook.
Xuyin pushes back.
She does. She strips away the superficial layer of the request, the lost jewelry, and exposes the brutal human stakes underneath. She explains that if this jade is not found, lives will be destroyed.
Oh, the servants' lives.
Exactly. The servants responsible for Baiyu, people like Xirin, they will face the wrath of the family patriarchs. Their actual survival depends on finding this stone. And when Miaoyu is confronted with the literal life-or-death gravity of the situation, her rigid doctrine shatters.
It's a moment of genuine, reluctant grace. She sighs, mutters about how she shouldn't be involving herself in these mortal entanglements, but she physically moves to help. She pulls out the spirit writing kit.
Which is a fascinating process in itself. In Taoist fuji rituals, you have a tray smoothed over with fine sand or ash and a planchette, often a suspended stick or a willow branch.
Like an ancient Ouija board, almost.
Sort of, yeah. The practitioner enters a trance state, invoking a deity, and the spirit supposedly guides their hands to trace characters in the sand, which an assistant then interprets and transcribes.
And Miaoyu, despite her earlier claims of ignorance, clearly knows exactly how to prepare this ritual.
Oh, she's an expert. She burns the incense, she focuses her mind, and she summons a spirit.
And the spirit that arrives is identified as the Crutch Immortal, which invokes the imagery of Iron Crutch Lai, right? One of the famous eight immortals in Chinese mythology.
That's the one.
And through Miaoyu's hands, this immortal traces a highly cryptic poem into the sand. This poem is the pivot point for everything that follows in the garden.
Do you have the translation handy?
Yeah, I do. It reads, "Alas, coming without a trace, going without a footprint, leaning against the ancient pine beneath the Blue Ridge Peak, wishing to seek it, mountains are a myriad fold. Enter my door and we shall meet with a smile."
It is a masterpiece of cosmic ambiguity, and the immediate aftermath of this poem being read is just this devastating study in confirmation bias and the tragedy of a limited perspective.
Because they just don't get it.
They completely miss it. You have these mortal characters reading a transmission from a divine entity, and they immediately try to shrink that massive cosmic riddle down so it fits into the tiny manicured geography of their own garden.
They literally miss the forest for the trees. Because Li Wan, who is deeply practical and manages much of the day-to-day household affairs, she reads the line about leaning against the ancient pine beneath the Blue Ridge Peak, and her brain immediately goes to landscaping.
It's so tragic.
She thinks, oh, Blue Ridge Peak must be a secret poetic code name for one of the decorative stone rockeries out in our courtyard. And there's a pine tree near it. Someone must have dropped it out back.
It's tragically ironic because the poem is pointing directly to the absolute mythological origins of the jade. The Blue Ridge Peak refers to the spiritual realm, the mythological foundation of the world where the goddess Nua abandoned a block of stone.
The exact same stone that incarnated into the human world as Baiyu's jade.
Exactly. The immortal is not giving them a treasure map. The Immortal is stating a cosmological fact. The Jade has returned to its divine source. But Li Wan's entire universe is confined to the walls of the Ronggu Mansion. She cannot conceive of a geography larger than her own estate.
It's like finding an ancient star chart mapping the entire Milky Way and assuming it's a diagram showing you where you buried your car keys in the backyard.
That is exactly what it's like.
They cannot comprehend the scale of the information they've been given. And then Dayu reads the line, "Enter my door and we shall meet with a smile," and her mind goes to the exact same literal place. She starts wondering, whose door is the spirit talking about? Which room?
They are prisoners of their physical reality. The information asymmetry is staggering. Everyone in the compound is operating on different sets of flawed data.
Right.
Beaming has his pawn shop gossip. Miao Yu has a divine riddle that she herself cannot decode. Lei Wan has her practical, garden-level interpretation, and Dayu has an entirely different, deeply internalized, psychological interpretation of the crisis.
Which is so fascinating, because while the rest of the household is in a state of sheer panic, running around the rockeries and checking the gates, Dayu retreats to her room, and her internal reaction is completely contradictory to the chaos outside.
She's relieved.
She is secretly, profoundly relieved. She is glad that Jade is gone.
And to understand why Dayu feels this relief, you really have to understand the suffocating psychological weight she's been carrying for years.
The prophecy.
Yes. The entire household is permeated by the rumor of the Golden Jade Destiny. This is an implied, almost cosmic prophecy, suggesting that Baiyu, who possesses the jade, is destined by heaven to marry Baochai, who possesses a golden locket.
And for Dayu, who shares this deep soul-level connection and a desperate love with Baiyu, this prophecy is a daily torture.
It's a constant reminder that her future is not her own.
So she's sitting in her room, and the logic clicking into place in her mind is fascinating. She thinks that if the physical jade is permanently lost, then the metaphysical goal in jade match is broken.
The hardware required for the prophecy is missing, therefore the prophecy is void.
Right. It clears the path for her own romance with Baiyu.
It highlights the absolute helplessness of individuals in a rigid, aristocratic, arranged marriage system. Dayu has zero agency over her own future. She cannot simply choose to marry Baiyu. The matriarchs and the patriarchs decide everything.
So she's desperate.
Completely. When you are trapped in a system that offers you no control, you will latch onto any piece of chaos, any disruption in the natural order that might break the machinery holding you down. Dayu feels imprisoned by the Golden Jade narrative. The disappearance of the jade is the very first time she feels the heavy, inevitable weight of the future lift off her shoulders.
But she doesn't get to simply bask in that relief. Her mind won't let her. Because the moment she finds a silver lining in the lost jade, she looks out into her courtyard and sees a begonia tree.
And this is where it turns.
Yeah. This begonia tree has suddenly, inexplicably bloomed out of season. It is winter and the tree is flowering. Suddenly, she is thrown violently from relief right back into terror.
Because in the literary and cultural context of the era, anomalies in nature, like a tree blooming in the dead of winter, are never just biological quirks.
Right. They're not just, oh, the weather's been weird.
No, they are severe omens. They represent a disruption of yin and yang, an inversion of the natural order. A winter bloom is a harbinger of instability, often signaling the fall of a house or the impending death of a vital family member.
So Dayu is caught in this agonizing mental trap. She thinks, the lost jade is good for me because it breaks the prophecy. But then she looks at the unseasonal flowers and the logic reverses. She thinks, wait, the jade is a protective amulet? If these unnatural flowers are a sign of impending doom or dark energy, and Bayou's protective shield is gone, then the boy I love is completely exposed to whatever evil is coming.
The text says she spends the entire night tossing and turning until the fifth watch, oscillating between the joy of a broken prophecy and the terror of an impending disaster.
It's such a masterful depiction of cognitive dissonance and anxiety. She is trying desperately to read the tea leaves of a chaotic universe. She has the blooming tree, the missing stone, the cryptic poem from the immortal, and she is trying to force all these disparate, terrifying signs into a coherent narrative that tells her she will be safe.
And she simply cannot do it.
And while Dayu is trapped in that agonizing internal uncertainty, looking for signs in a single blooming tree, the adults in the family are about to get hit with a sign from the external world that requires absolutely no interpretation.
The pivot here is incredible.
The narrative violently shifts our focus from the localized spiritual anxiety of the younger generation to the brutal, unforgiving political reality of the older generation.
The contrast is brilliant. The younger generation is obsessed with poetry, love, and mystical stones. The adults are entirely focused on the mechanics of state power.
Yeah, because Jilian, who acts as the family's external fixer and business manager, comes rushing into the inner quarters with news that changes the entire atmosphere of the estate.
False dawn.
Exactly. He announces to Lady Wang, Baiyu's mother, that her brother, who has been serving in a regional outer province post, has just been promoted to Grand Secretary and is being recalled to the capital.
And to understand Lady Wang's reaction, we have to look at how factional politics and patronage networks operated in the Qing Dynasty court. A Grand Secretary is not just a prestigious title. It places a man in the absolute highest echelon of the imperial cabinet.
Like inner circle.
Very inner circle. He is drafting edicts. He's standing in proximity to the emperor. For a wealthy, aristocratic family like the Jias, their survival depends entirely on having powerful allies within the government apparatus to protect their massive wealth and land holdings from political rivals.
And Lady Wang's relief is palpable in the text. She has been sitting in the estate watching the family's fortunes slowly wane, watching allied families suffer political purges, feeling increasingly vulnerable.
Yeah, the pressure has been building.
So hearing that her brother is returning to the capital as a Grand Secretary is like watching an impenetrable fortress wall being built around their estate overnight.
The text notes that she specifically thinks of Baiyu's future. She reasons that with a Grand Secretary for an uncle, Baiyu will have an untouchable political safety net. This external political victory is so overwhelming that it actually acts as an anesthetic for her internal anxieties. She essentially stops worrying about the missing jade.
Which is an incredible display of hubris, right?
Oh, absolutely.
She fundamentally believes that worldly bureaucratic power can compensate for a metaphysical loss. She assumes that the emperor's favor, manifested through her brother's promotion, is a stronger shield than a divine amulet. She feels completely untouchable.
And the source text sets up this moment of supreme, arrogant confidence purely to demolish it in the very next scene.
The whiplash is crazy, because Lady Wang is basking in the glow of new political armor, and suddenly Jia Zhang, the patriarch, the rigid Confucian head of the family, enters the room, and he is breathless, and he is weaving.
Which is shocking. For a man whose entire public persona is built on stoicism, emotional restraint, and strict adherence to propriety, entering the inner quarters in tears is the equivalent of a siren going off.
It tells everyone in the room that an apocalyptic event has occurred.
Exactly. He manages to tell them that Imperial Consort Yuan, their daughter, who is a high-ranking concubine to the emperor, has contracted a sudden, incurable illness.
We really have to pause here and look at what the imperial consort represents to this family. Having a daughter in the inner palace is the bedrock of the Jia family's elite status.
She is their ultimate anchor.
Her presence in the palace is the reason they have such immense wealth and influence. Her sudden illness is not just a family tragedy, it is a direct threat to the survival of the entire clan.
And the source material is incredibly specific about her condition. It doesn't just vaguely state she fell ill. It provides a detailed clinical description rooted in traditional Chinese medicine.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this. What does the text actually say?
Well, the text notes that since entering the oppressive environment of the palace, Yuanfei had gained weight, suffered from profound chronic fatigue, and struggled with persistent phlegm. It explains that she recently attended a banquet, caught a sudden chill, and this minor exposure triggered a catastrophic systemic collapse that the imperial doctors diagnose as phlegm syncope.
Phlegm syncope.
Yes. In the framework of traditional Chinese medicine, the body is viewed as a landscape of flowing energy, or qi, and vital fluids. The diagnosis of phlegm syncope is deeply symbolic. In this medical philosophy, when a person experiences prolonged emotional stagnation, such as the suffocating anxiety, the rigid surveillance, and the intense psychological pressure of living as an imperial consort, their qi stops flowing smoothly.
So the stress physically manifests.
Exactly. When qi stagnates, fluids begin to accumulate and thicken, turning into what is conceptually called phlegm. This is not just a respiratory issue, it is a metaphysical blockage.
Wow. So the chill she caught at the banquet wasn't the root cause. It was just the spark that ignited years of accumulated physical and emotional trauma.
Precisely. The sudden influx of cold caused this internal, stagnant phlegm to solidify and completely block the meridians, the vital energy channels of her body. The text is vivid in its horror. Her vital energy is trapped, unable to reach her extremities, leading to freezing cold limbs. The phlegm surges upward, completely blocking her throat, rendering her entirely incapable of speech.
That is horrifying. She's conscious, she's suffering, but she is locked inside a body that is shut down.
And the physical description implies so much about the unnatural, toxic environment of the Imperial Palace. The text mentions the heavy, saintly favor she receives, meaning the Emperor's attention, but pairs it with the immense exertion of her daily life.
The palace is a gilded cage of immense pressure.
Her physical body literally could not sustain the crushing weight of her political reality. The phlegm blocking her throat is the physical manifestation of a life spent swallowing her true feelings, constantly watching her words, and living in perpetual anxiety.
And that oppressive, suffocating atmosphere follows the family when they are summoned to the palace, because the tragedy of a dying daughter is immediately, brutally compounded by the cold, unyielding cruelty of royal protocol.
Yeah, Jia Zhang tells Lady Wang and Grandmother Jia to go to the palace, but warns them to speak gently so as not to frighten the old lady. He is trying to manage the optics of grief before they even leave the house.
It's all about protocol. They rush to the inner palace, and the scene they encounter is agonizing. Grandma Jia and Lady Wang finally see Yuanfei. Her throat is entirely blocked. She cannot say a single word of comfort or goodbye. The text describes her looking at her grandmother and mother with a face carved with deep sorrow, but she has very few tears left to shed. Her body is completely spent.
And the true horror is how Grandmother Jia must react. She's watching her beloved granddaughter suffocate. But she is not in her own home. She is in the inner sanctum of the Emperor.
So she can't just act like a grandmother.
No. Protocol dictates that she cannot rush to the bed, pull Yuanfei into her arms, and wail. She has to maintain the rigid decorum of a subject addressing a royal consort. She has to step forward and offer polite, formal, completely hollow words of comfort.
That is heartbreaking.
The human instinct to mourn is forcibly suppressed by the state's demand for order.
It is entirely dehumanizing. And then the palace machinery grinds them down even further. They are not even permitted to stay in the room as she dies.
Because of the regulations.
Right. The text explains that due to strict palace regulations, the family is forced to withdraw. The inner palace eunuchs inform them that the emperor might send other consorts or officials to check on the situation, and it is highly inappropriate for outside relatives to be loitering in the royal chambers.
It is a profound statement on the nature of imperial power. Yuanfei is dying, but the state machinery does not view her as a dying human being or a beloved daughter. The state views her as a piece of imperial property whose function is expiring. The protocols of the institution take absolute precedence over the profound grief of the family. Grandmother Jia and Lady Wang are escorted to an outer waiting room. They are explicitly forbidden from crying out loud because loud lamentations disrupt the harmony of the palace. They have to swallow their agony and sit in absolute silence.
Just sitting in that outer room, trapped in a silent nightmare, until a eunuch finally emerges to announce the official passing of Consort Jia. And the source text does not just move on here. It pauses to give us incredibly specific astrological and chronological data about the exact moment of her death.
And those details are crucial.
It states she was 43 years old. She passed away on the 19th day of the 12th month. And it explicitly notes that this exact moment occurred just as the calendar shifted into the year of the Wood Tiger, the year of Mao and the month of Yin, immediately following the solar term known as the beginning of spring.
We really cannot gloss over those astrological specifics. They are the architectural framework of the tragedy.
Break that down for us.
In the Chinese cosmological calendar, time operates in cycles of elements and animals. The beginning of spring, or Li Chun, is a major solar term. It represents the exact pivot point where the dead, stagnant energy of winter is supposed to give way to the vibrant, growing energy of spring. The year of the Wood Tiger represents massive growth, vitality, and forward momentum.
Wait, so she dies at the exact second the universe is mathematically scheduled to burst into life?
Yes. Her death at 43 marks a catastrophic cosmological short circuit for the Jia family. At the very moment the calendar promises spring, the family plunges into an eternal winter. The impermanence of power is laid completely bare.
Wow.
The family's ultimate shield, the imperial consort who justified their entire existence, is extinguished in a matter of hours. It proves that all of Lady Wang's hubris about her brother's promotion, All their reliance on titles, wealth, and bureaucratic influence is as fragile as a single human body catching a chill after a banquet.
So the political shield is gone. The family leaves the oppressive silence of the palace and returns to the sprawling grounds of their estate, desperately needing a safe harbor. But waiting for them back at the mansion is the realization that their spiritual shield has also completely collapsed in their absence.
Wow. Things have gotten worse at home.
Without the jade, Bayou has continued to deteriorate. The center cannot hold. While the adults were navigating the deadly politics of the capital, the servants caring for Bayou have been facing a localized apocalypse of their own. Bayou is not simply grieving the loss of his jewelry. He is actively dissociating from reality.
The specific symptoms of his madness are deeply unsettling because they are entirely passive.
He's not violent or anything.
Right, he doesn't have a raging fever. He isn't thrashing around the room in physical agony or having violent delusions. The text describes a much quieter, more terrifying deterioration. His daily routine is completely shattered. He just sits there.
Like a shell.
He only eats if a servant physically places a bowl of food directly in front of him. He laughs with a foolish, empty sound. When he speaks, the words are total nonsense.
It's a state of profound dissociation. In Chinese philosophical terms, it is the scattering of the soul. The physical vessel, the body, is intact. But the animating essence, the fundamental consciousness that makes him who he is, has evaporated along with the stone.
Which is exactly like a computer that has had its operating system completely wiped.
Yes. The hardware is in perfect condition. There is no physical damage to the motherboard, the screen powers on, the battery is full. But when you look at the monitor, there is nothing there. The software that contained his empathy, his poetic brilliance, his emotional connection to the people around him, it has all been deleted.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. He's been reduced to a biological automaton. And the true horror of this state is brought into sharp focus when Grandmother Jia, having just returned from the agonizing trauma of watching her granddaughter die in the palace, decides she needs to see Bayou.
And the servants panic.
They are paralyzed with fear that she will discover his hollow state, leading to this scene of grotesque emotional manipulation.
Yeah, Zirin, the senior maid, essentially turns herself into a puppeteer. Grandmother Jia walks into the room, and Bayou manages to go through the basic physical motions of a greeting. But the text reveals that Zirin is standing right next to him, physically propping him up and whispering the exact words he needs to say into his ear.
She feeds him his lines.
And he blindly, mechanically echoes them back to his grandmother. He is functioning as a literal ventriloquist's dummy.
It is a desperate, grotesque performance, and it really highlights the architecture of fear that governs the servant class. Zirin is engaging in a massive deception, risking everything to maintain a razor-thin illusion of normalcy.
Why is she doing that?
She is doing this to protect herself and the other servants from the devastating consequences of failure in a strict hierarchy. But the illusion is too fragile to survive Grandmother Jia's scrutiny.
Grandmother Jia is far too observant. She watches this stilted mechanical performance for a few moments, and the truth dawns on her. She says, "I didn't see it at first, but looking closely, this isn't just an illness. He looks like someone whose soul has scattered."
She sees straight through the puppet show.
And that is the moment the entire cover-up collapses. Grandmother Jia corners Lady Wang and demands the truth. She exerts her absolute authority, and Lady Wang finally breaks down and confesses that the jade has been missing for days.
But you know, looking at this cover-up, we have to ask why it happened in the first place.
Right. Why would Lady Wang, who is a matriarch in her own right, and a fleet of loyal servants, hide the loss of the most important object in the house for days? It seems insane. Was it just pure cowardice, or does it speak to something darker about how this family operates?
It speaks volumes about the toxic flow of information in a heavily patriarchal Confucian hierarchy. It was not mere cowardice. It was an entirely rational, survival-based calculation.
How so?
The text reveals a crucial detail. The jade was lost during a visit to the Prince of Nanan's mansion. They were absolutely terrified of Jia Zhang's reaction. Jia Zhang has a history of brutal physical violence against Bayou when the boy fails to live up to expectations.
Oh, wow.
They feared his rage would be uncontrollable. Furthermore, they were terrified of causing Grandmother Jia anxiety because causing distress to an elder is considered a severe violation of filial piety.
So in this environment, information is a dangerous liability.
Exactly. Information does not flow freely. It is aggressively managed, hidden, and suppressed out of fear of punishment. Lady Wang hid the truth because she desperately hoped a localized, secret searchlight checking the gardens or even the pawn shops would miraculously solve the problem before the supreme authority figures ever found out.
She prioritized avoiding immediate punishment over addressing the actual crisis. But once the truth is out, Grandmother Jia's reaction shifts the entire dynamic. Because she doesn't panic in the localized, street-level way the servants did. She doesn't suggest checking the pawn shops. She takes immediate, sweeping control of the situation, and her actions reveal exactly how she views the missing jade.
She doesn't see it as jewelry.
No. She recognizes it as a catastrophic breach in their metaphysical security system.
Grandmother Jia possesses a deeply spiritual worldview. She explicitly states that the jade was the singular object warding off evil spirits from Baiyu. She immediately connects the dots that everyone else was too panicked to see.
The plants, right?
Exactly. She looks at the sudden withering of plants in the garden and the unseasonal blooming of the begonia tree that terrified Daiyu, and she synthesizes that information. She declares that these horticultural anomalies are proof that without the jade, dark, invasive energy is flooding into the household.
She realizes the shields are down. If we think back to that stone archway metaphor, she sees that the keystone is missing, and she can hear the mortar cracking. So she enacts a protocol of spiritual triage. She orders Baiyu to be physically removed from his quarters in the sprawling garden and brought directly into her own personal suite of rooms.
She understands that Baiyu is entirely porous right now. By moving him into her quarters, she is establishing a physical and spiritual quarantine.
That's a great way to put it.
She reasons that her rooms are cleaner, filled with Buddhist scriptures and artifacts, and more importantly, she believes her own immense personal aura, her accumulated fortune and spiritual weight as the matriarch, can help suppress the evil energy now that his personal shield is gone. She is using her own life force as a substitute for the stone.
It is a brilliant, decisive move, but she is also deeply pragmatic. She knows her own aura is just a temporary patch.
Yeah.
They need the actual physical hardware back to restore the system. And this realization leads her to abandon all the secrecy and deploy a desperate, aggressively public tactic. She decides to weaponize the family's immense wealth.
Which brings us to a fascinating collision of the spiritual and the economic. Grandmother Jia decides that a private crisis must become a public spectacle if they are going to survive.
She completely bypasses all the men in the family. The men who are obsessed with reputation and propriety, and she issues a direct order to Jia Lian. She commands him to draft a massive public reward poster, and the numbers she throws out are staggering.
They really are.
She offers a bounty of 10,000 taels of silver for the physical return of the jade, and 5,000 taels just for verified information leading to its recovery.
We really need to contextualize the sheer gravity of that number. 10,000 taels of silver is an economy-wrecking sum of money.
Like, how much are we talking?
Well, a single tael is roughly an ounce of silver. In the Qing Dynasty economy, peasant families could survive an entire year on just a few taels. 10,000 taels is the kind of wealth that can purchase massive agricultural estates, fund regional armies, or instantly elevate a commoner to the status of a wealthy lord.
So it's life-changing money.
Beyond life-changing. It is an act of unadulterated desperation. Grandmother Jia is attempting to use overwhelming financial force to bend the universe to her will.
But when you broadcast that level of desperation and that amount of money to the entire capital city, there is massive collateral damage because Jia Zhang, who is entirely out of the loop on this plan, is riding in his carriage through the city streets, and he overhears commoners, merchants, and idlers gossiping about this massive bounty.
They're discussing the exact dimensions, the color, and the specific engravings of Baiyu's jade because every single detail was explicitly listed on the poster.
Right, and Jia Zhang's reaction to this is incredibly telling about his character and his priorities.
Yet.
He doesn't hear this gossip and feel relief that a massive search effort is underway. He is absolutely fundamentally mortified.
Oh, completely.
Wait, his son is sitting in a room, completely hollowed out, unable to even feed himself without a maid whispering in his ear. And Jia Zhang's immediate emotional reaction is embarrassment over what random guys on the street are gossiping about. That borders on narcissistic.
It does, but it is deeply rooted in his rigid adherence to Confucian social structures. Jia Zhang's entire identity is built around the concept of mianzi, or face, and the strict division between the inner world of the aristocratic household and the outer world of the public.
Ah, I see.
For the deeply private spiritual crisis of a noble house to become fodder for street-level gossip is a profound degradation. He views it as a grotesque public spectacle. He literally declares it a sign of the family's ultimate decline, that they have been reduced to begging the peasantry for help to find a rock.
He is so paralyzed by this shame that he secretly orders his servants to tear the posters down. He tries to sabotage the only viable recovery effort because he can't handle the embarrassment.
Although the text adds a great detail noting that idle hands and scavengers had already stolen most of the posters anyway.
It perfectly highlights the flaw in his leadership, though. He operates entirely on how things look, whereas Grandmother Gia operates on what things are.
And what things are, reality-wise, is that the family has just handed every bad actor, grifter, and con artist in the capital the exact blueprint needed to defraud them.
It is the 18th century equivalent of a massive phishing scam. If you go into the public square and say, I lost a key, it is exactly 3 inches long, made of brass, it has three distinct ridges, and the serial number is 1234. I will pay you $10 million if you bring it to me.
You're providing the exact manufacturing specs for a forgery.
You are begging to be scammed.
And the scammer inevitably arrives. The text introduces a poor man who shows up at the imposing gates of the Rongro mansion, claiming he has the jade and wants the reward. The dynamic of this scene is a brilliant exploration of inverted class structures.
This man is incredibly bold. He doesn't cower. He actively mocks the elite gatekeepers who usually terrorize the commoners. He looks at them and says, you look down on me right now because I'm poor and wearing rags, but the second I hand this over and get my silver, I'm going to be a rich man, so you'd better show some respect.
The 10,000 tail bounty has completely destabilized the social hierarchy. For this brief moment, a peasant off the street holds all the power. The arrogant gatekeepers of this massive estate have to bow and scrape, rushing to serve him tea, because he might be holding the salvation of their master in a little silk bundle.
Jilian brings the man inside, treats him like an honored guest, and takes the bundle to the inner quarters for verification. And when they unwrap it, at first glance, it is highly convincing. It is a piece of crystalline jade. It matches the size perfectly. And it even has the specific characters reading ward off evil spirits engraved on the surface, exactly as Jilian described on the bounty poster.
But the senior women in the family, whose entire lives have been spent evaluating the quality of silks, jewels, and people, spot the deception almost immediately.
Grandmother Gia puts on her reading glasses, takes the stone in her hand, rubs the surface, and frowns. She says, this is strange. The shape is right, and the words are right, but all the brilliant color, the inner luster that the real one had, is completely gone.
And Shifeng, who is arguably the sharpest and most ruthless manager in the household, takes one look at it and confirms that the color is entirely off.
The forgery serves as a perfect philosophical metaphor from the title of the chapter. The fake mixes with the real.
Yes.
The scammer has executed a perfect superficial copy. He nailed the physical dimensions, he copied the text, he replicated the form. But he cannot replicate the intrinsic luminous essence of the divine object. It is a dead rock masquerading as a living artifact.
And this leads to what is, without a doubt, the most profound and moving moment in the entire chapter. They are sitting there debating the authenticity of the stone, and someone suggests they simply show it to Baoyu.
And remember the state Baoyu is in.
He is a hollow vessel. He is dissociating, unable to speak a coherent sentence, stripped of his consciousness. But they walk over to him and place this highly convincing fake jade into his hand. And his reaction is instantaneous.
He does not inspect the engravings. He does not hold it up to the light to check the color. The text notes he barely even looks at it. He feels the weight of it in his palm and he immediately throws it onto the ground. He laughs this cold, dismissive laugh and says, "You're trying to fool me again."
It's breathtaking. Even completely lost in the fog of his madness, even without his soul actively steering his body, his intrinsic fundamental connection to his true nature remains entirely uncorrupted.
He intimately knows the metaphysical shape of his own soul, and he knows instantly that this dead rock isn't it.
It is a moment of profound, piercing clarity cutting straight through the dissociation. It demonstrates that the bond between Baoyu and the real jade is not merely symbolic, it is ontological. It is woven into the very fabric of his being. You cannot trick his spirit with a replica, no matter how skilled the carver was.
So the forgery is definitively exposed. The tension in the room breaks, and Jilian, who had been so eager to be the hero who found the jade, is absolutely furious. His pride is wounded. He wants to march right back out to the reception room, grab the scammer, and subject him to severe physical punishment for daring to defraud the powerful Gia family.
But this is where Grandmother Gia steps in and delivers an absolute masterclass in grand strategy and crisis leadership.
She really does. The contrast between how the men and the women in this family wield power is starkly illuminated here. Gia Lian and Gia Zheng both default immediately to aggression, punishment, and pride when their status is challenged. But Grandmother Gia exercises brilliant strategic restraint. She understands the long game.
She stops Gia Lian dead in his tracks. She says, no, do not make things difficult for him. Give him back his fake jade, politely tell him it's not ours, and give him a few taels of silver for his trouble.
She actually pays the man who just tried to steal 10,000 taels from them.
She does. And her reasoning is pure, unadulterated genius. She explains that if word spreads through the capital that the Gia family beats and punishes men who bring in the wrong jade, then anyone who eventually finds the real jade will be far too terrified to ever approach the gates.
It is an incredible display of emotional intelligence and foresight. She recognizes the economic reality. The scammer is just a desperate man trying to survive in a harsh world, much like they're trying to survive their own crisis.
But more importantly, she understands the mechanics of human psychology. If you establish a reputation for aggressively punishing those who attempt to help you, even if their help is fraudulent and self-serving, you permanently shut down your only pipeline to the truth.
She is willing to swallow the immense insult of the scam and even financially compensate the scammer purely to keep the channel of communication open.
She is securing the future while the men are reacting to short-term bruises to their egos.
She is essentially establishing a policy that says, we have to leave the door wide open for the truth, even if it means watching a few liars walk through it first. It is a powerful, deeply pragmatic approach to a seemingly impossible, chaotic situation.